His name is Freddy Krueger. He was a child murderer before he died. And after he died, well, he became something worse. Welcome to episode 4 of Once Upon a Nightmare. I am your host Lorraine and I'm here to discuss the horrors of the world, be it fictional or real. This is my second attempt at this particular episode because when I recorded it before, the screams of children could be heard throughout from my neighbours, which I didn't think was really fitting for the episode I'm about to do. We don't really want to hear screaming children. Anyway, this week we are going fictional. I seem to have a bit of a pattern of doing real and fictional. And I think I'm going to keep it that way, kind of get my fix. And I'm going to attempt my first full-blown true crime episode for my next one. It's a story that's really stuck with me, and I can't stop thinking about one of the survivors, so I thought I would do that story. But back to this episode, which will have spoilers, by the way. For this one, I'm going with one of my all-time favourite fictional characters who has been in my life since the late 80s. Sounds like an old boyfriend, doesn't it? When I was old enough to watch him. He terrified me then, and he terrifies me now. It is, of course, Freddy Krueger. Freddy Krueger, for those of you who do not know, is the bad guy from a Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And I'm going to look at the third installment of that franchise with A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Razors on his right hand. Man of my dreams. He's real, isn't he? He's real. Let go of him, you bastard.
Nightmare on Elm Street and, of course, Freddy Krueger first came to light in Wes Craven's 1984 movie. That was the first one. The Elm Street franchise, it is a bit up and down. I personally love the first one the most. And then, of course, the third. But I haven't seen the others in quite a long time, so I would have to rewatch them to give a true opinion on them. Craven is known for his horror and has released some amazing horror movies. He really is one of the top dogs when it comes to horror with films such as Scream 1-4, Hills of Eyes, Last House on the Left, etc. And he really left his mark before, unfortunately, he passed away in 2015. While Craven did create the character, he didn't have full involvement with all of them like he did with the first one, but he did co-write the screenplay for A Nightmare on Elm Street 3 for a 1987 release. But in 1994, Craven returned to the character of Freddy Krueger with a new nightmare. Krueger was such an interesting character for me because the place where you should be the most safe was the place that was most dangerous. Plus, how do you get someone to believe that a man is trying to kill you in your actual dreams. We all have bad nightmares, sleep paralysis. I don't know if you've ever had that. It's awful. Horrific night's sleep, which are bad enough. But to think that you could actually die by being brutally murdered, that would terrify you to the point where you would not want to sleep. Sleep deprivation is torture. It's real. I've had it myself. I have a kid. But despite trying to stay awake for as long as you possibly can, if you are suffering from Freddy trying to kill you, you are eventually going to fall asleep. Freddy Krueger has mostly been portrayed by horror icon Robert Englund. He has been played by others, but Englund will always be Krueger to me, and probably Krueger to most. Freddy is a serial child killer known as the Springwoods Slasher, who was murdered by a group of parents who killed him after he evaded a prison sentence for his crimes. And while Krueger is a fictional character, the idea came to Craven after reading about a string of deaths of young people in the 70s, early 80s with the Hmong, I hope I said that right, refugees, who were living in America at the time after they escaped a Cambodian genocide. And they just died in their sleep for no reason. His previous films, you know, were based on like maniacs attacking families, groups of maniacs attacking families. And in Freddy, he kind of changed his way of writing after reading the story of these unexplained deaths. And this is, of course, how he came up with the idea for Mr. Freddy Krueger, attacking people in their dreams. Also, Freddy, he has a very distinct style, his look. And that comes from quite a few places. The jumper that is red and green, it comes from a 1982 scientific article about how those two colours, they clash the most. And the hat was worn by a man that used to scare him when he was a kid. And the name Freddy Krueger comes from a child bully. Can you imagine a film being created and one of the sickest fuckers in the world is named after you? I would like to know what that guy thinks. If anyone knows what that guy thinks, let me know. The first Elm Street, though, that really kind of stepped away from what we're used to in horror with regards to where it's set. As I've mentioned in other episodes, we tend to look at horror in certain locations that automatically bring a sense of fear, isolation. But Craven, he doesn't really do this in the first one. It's set in basically the American dream. It's like the perfect street, really, isn't it? It's also bright, nice houses, wealth. It does look like the perfect location, but like a typical thing, you never really know what's going on behind closed doors, and you would never think it was that. Elm Street 3, on the other hand, it kind of brings us back to a location that is terrifying, and that is the use of an asylum. They are so scary, and what really terrifies me the most of them, obviously the history of them and the things you've seen, but it's the fact that people have so much power over you. The staff have so much power over you. And that I could not take. And it's no wonder you see these people freaking out, because they've got people tying them down and all sorts. So you can't really blame them. Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors is an 18. It's a horror fantasy and runs for just over about an hour and a half. It has a budget of $4.5 million, so they upped it. And it took just under $45 million worldwide. I think people do tend to forget, though, what this franchise has done for films. Had it not come along, New Line Productions may have not survived. And, you know, it went on to bring us the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Plus, it spawned one of the greatest horror icons there is. And it has also been part of 9 films. There's been TV series, there's been books, there's been comic books, there's merchandises, and there's been appearances at Comic-Con, which my brother got to see him. I went and seen Sigourney Weaver. He went and seen Freddy Krueger. It's just a money machine. This particular installment was directed by a Chuck Russell. And as I mentioned, it was released in 1987. This was, in fact, Russell's first time directing, and he came in with a vision of how he wanted the script to go. There are a few writing credits to this movie. We have, of course, Wes Craven, Bruce Wagner, Walking Dead's Frank Darabont, and, of course, director Chuck Russell. Craven and Wagner, they had a script where Krueger could basically do what he wanted. There was no limits to his powers. But line producer Rachel Talalay, she thought their version, it wasn't ideal. There was no rules. And from a production point of view, it wasn't doable. But also, this would take away from the fear of Freddy. How could you fight something that can do anything? You couldn't defeat him. So she brought Russell in, and obviously he brought along Frank Darabont. And between them all, they came up with the version that we see today. That version is as follows. The third installment sees a new batch of troubled teens for Freddy to torment. In Dream Warriors, it takes us away from people's houses and into a lovely psychiatric ward. Kirsten Parker, played by Patricia Arquette, has her wrists slit by Krueger while in a nightmare. Her mother walks in on her with bloodied wrists holding a razor, and she has had enough of her antics and attention seeking and takes her to the hospital. When Kirsten arrives, she is fighting the staff as they're trying to sedate her. This hysterical new patient, no one can calm her. And that is, of course, until Nancy Thompson walks in, played by Heather Langenkamp. You may remember her from the first one. She survived. Thompson was, of course, the final girl. Nancy sees something in Kirsten to rid the children of Freddy and begins working with her and other kids within the ward to try and stop Freddy from killing them all in their dreams, and is met with an abundance of fight back from other staff. Elm Street is quite fast-paced, and it kind of gets into it straight away. We see Kirsten guzzling Coke with spoonfuls of coffee to keep her awake, but eventually, you're not going to stay awake forever. There is not much time wasted in getting Kirsten committed and introducing her to all the other patients, and the nightmare begins quite quickly for them all. The kids are examined by two doctors with very different approaches. We've got a Dr. Elizabeth Sims, played by Priscilla Pointer. Her approach is that of Nurse Ratchet, one flew over the cuckoo's nest-like figure. There is no warmth from her, and she just feels like they're playing up, looking for attention. She is the wrong person to be looking after them. She knows they have issues, but she isn't very compassionate about it at all. Neil Gordon, on the other hand, who's played by Craig Wasson, he has a lot more sympathy towards the children. With Sims, you kind of feel like it's just her job. She goes by the book. Gordon, though, he actually listens. He tries to relate more to the kids. And then, of course, we have Nancy, who is there to help the kids, because obviously she has a lot of first-hand experience. She joins the hospital and is, of course, their biggest ally, as she really, really gets it. Unfortunately, though, Sims doesn't see her that way. She is able to tell the children who the man is who haunts their dreams, but also they're to show them they're not insane. This is very much real and they can actually die. I really enjoyed this scene when she describes to the children who he is, and I know you know who she's talking about, but you really feel it with them when she explains it all. It's this moment we can all relate to of not being heard, then finally someone is on your side. It's nice for that moment for the kids to not only have someone to believe in what they're saying, but the relief that you're not going insane. You know those moments when you're saying something and no one's listening? There's nothing more infuriating than you trying to get your point across and someone's like, nah, that's not what it is. It really fucks me off. The good thing about Nancy explaining this to them is they can see that this is actually happening. They're not a bunch of attention-seeking kids who just couldn't hack it on the outside. And it's a really pivotal scene, as I feel this really bonds them all together. This is a scene that makes them the team they become, as they now know who and what, for that matter, they are fighting. So they can now actually make some sort of plan of how to actually get rid of Freddy. And they have, obviously, Nancy as, you know, the leader of the pack. One major issue, though, with defeating Freddy is trying to actually differentiate between what is real and what isn't. You know, what parts of this film are actually real? With Elm Street, there is blurred lines between what is real and what is the nightmare. There are times when watching this film, the audience are right up there with the characters, at times trying to figure out, you know, are they in a dream or are they awake? This installment, though, is quite different in how Freddy's tackled compared to the first one. In the first one, you know, you kind of mainly see Nancy as the person trying to kill him. Her other mates get knocked off one by one quite easily. But Elm Street 3, there's definitely strength in numbers. And while Kirsten is the main character, there is a group all fighting the same battle. Craven discusses in an interview how there's like a sense of unity where they don't feel so alone. And there's this message that's good for kids to see. Now, I know this is an 18, but it does send a message that you're not alone. You can find people that experience what you are, and you can help each other out, help each other survive it. And that's what Dream Warriors is really, isn't it? It's a little gang of mates all there for each other. Because also teenagers and young adults, they can have quite the strained relationships with their parents, as is evident in this movie. And we look to our peers to get us by, especially the ones who are going through the same thing. This installment has a lot of hype around it with the younger audience. They had the first film only 3 years earlier, and with a second one in 85, which doesn't really get much love around it. And then you're hit with this group of relatable kids whose parents don't understand them or they just don't care. And these kids are put together, and the worst thing is they are paying for the sins of their parents, the very parents who are so sick and tired of their antics, and they just don't want to hear it. And there was probably one or more character that you could relate to when you were a teenager, not being understood, and especially in times of isolation, you could look at these kids, you know, as a group that you wanted to be part of. Obviously not the whole Freddy bit, but because of the bond, you want to fit in. At the time, the popular horror magazine Fangoria actually dedicated quite a bit to this film around its release, and with the return of Nancy, of course, and her father, this would have enticed an audience to watch, as you want to know what happened to Nancy, you want to find out what she's done since. And, you know, it was quite the recipe for a great film. People wanted to see it. Plus, as the first one was such a success, it's no surprise that people were flocking to see this one. While the kids, though, all do have that one dream, they all share the dream of Freddy, Kirsten, she kind of has a different ability. She can bring people into her dreams to help her. We first get a taste of this when she's in a nightmare in a house and she's attacked by what can only be described as a giant penis reptilian shaped thing with Freddy's face on it as he tries to swallow her. Honestly, this thing is so disgusting. They didn't really use a lot of CGI at all times, and they went kind of for the more practical effects for the giant penis thing. It was like mechanical rigs, handmade puppets, a lot of manpower. And I watched behind the scenes, and it's pretty impressive how they do it. It's also really freaking gross. I think they did a good job of what they had to work with. And looking behind the scenes, you can see the lot of effort that went into it without the use of CGI. But most of the budget for this film actually did go in the special effects departments, because there is quite a lot of effects in this film. It's, they're good, but some are questionable. I felt could have been a bit better. One, for example, was the little girl with Kirsten's carrying when she's in that house in Elm Street, and she tries to save this little girl in a yellow dress. There is no resemblance to a real child there. And while she's, you know, changing, she changes to this corpse because she's obviously dead. It didn't work for me. And when she's carrying her, there's no weight to that child when she's carrying her. You can tell it's like a doll. But there is a little story to this, which wasn't actually the best outcome. There was supposed to be a different child created by special makeups effects artist Mark Shostrom, but he wasn't allowed to use the one he actually did at the insistence of Russell. Despite pleas from everyone to go ahead with Shostrom's creation, it just didn't happen, because Russell's notes when creating this draw was think Auschwitz. So they went off, did a lot of research, spent a lot of time and a lot of money. But when he saw it, he thought that everyone was going to hate him in the Jewish community and they wouldn't let him use it. So basically they were like, you need to get something else together. In a couple of minutes, they threw this together. But on the original thing, they spent 10 weeks creating it. So it must have been a bit of a kick in the teeth. And also, you've just wiped away a big whack of your budget there. But there's so many more effects in this film. It really is effects driven. The TV scene with Jennifer, you know, when he puts her through the telly, the puppet with Philip. When Freddy's bones evolve into a skeleton Freddy version, you know, when he gets up and he's walking around in this kind of like Ray Harryhausen style stop motion. You may have seen that in films such as Jason and the Argonauts and Clash of the Titans. And Argonauts was back in like 1963. So from that respect, I kind of feel like it didn't come that far. I think this is where it falls short today. But having said that, it's kind of unfair to compare today's effects to a film from the 80s. So apart from the little girl scene, I do still appreciate what they did with it all. One thing we do get from this film that may be down to England was a bit of a backstory. I feel we learn in this film a bit more where Kruger actually comes from. England himself, which I didn't know, I only recently found this out, he actually wrote a draft for this film, and he wanted a reintegration of the whole backstory of Freddy, which, you know, we get. And Craven must have taken this idea on board, as they really go into how Freddy came to be. In the first one, the parents are in this really big form of denial. They don't want to talk about it. And to be honest, it would be hard to believe such an insane story, but they should have revealed all they knew. We get it here. Freddy is described as the bastard son of 100 maniacs. That he is. After a worker was locked in overnight in the asylum where they all stayed, she is raped by so many patients. And here there's kind of this big, huge contrast between mother and son. The mother, Amanda Kruger, she was a nun, you know, pure. They're supposed to be pure, but that's for another time. A woman of God. Freddy, on the other hand, the opposite. He's basically the spawn of many madmen. he's an evil bastard. Amanda is a huge factor in this film as well, in making sure Kruger is killed and laid to rest for good. She appears to Neil and gives cryptic clues to suggest that Kruger can, in fact, be destroyed. While I get this is the way it has to be, these types of things kind of really frustrate me. You're like, will you just fucking spit it out? You know, it's all these like, if you do this, if you do that, you know, it's like, just tell me what to do. But Neil, he's a man of science, so he's going to have a lot of issues trying to rationalize this. But this is a film where science needs to be kind of put aside for 1 minute and you kind of take a leap of faith. I think for the time of this movie, it was kind of representative of what was actually going on. The 70s and the 80s was a time when people would try and take the grasp of the concept of science. And, you know, its gap between it and religion, like religion has been at the forefront for many hundreds and hundreds of years. And people do still very much believe in it and the powers of it. I myself am not a religious person, so would have struggled like Neil. But I think when certain things cannot be explained, like what's happening to these kids, then you kind of have to think outside the box because what's happening to them isn't the norm. So this is where having someone like Dr. Neil involved is essential. It takes a bit of time, but he does open his mind to it. Dr. Sims, on the other hand, I don't think she would have been very accommodating. But at the end of the day, Amanda does show herself to Neil for a reason. She must have felt he was a good fit for what she had to say and that he'd actually listen and try and do something. Like, the deaths happen in a way that doesn't obviously suggest that a madman is haunting them. It looks like suicide. So their fears are not rational to others. So this gives Freddy like the ultimate weapon, playing on their fears and desires while making it impossible for people to believe what they are going through is real. One such desire is with Joey, and it also, you know, falls into one of the tropes where we see throughout horror movies in general, that is the horny teenager. Joey has what he thinks is a sexual experience with a kind of playboy fantasy-esque moment that of course goes dreadfully wrong. It's with a nurse he's attracted to, and, you know, in one of his dreams, and of course the nurse is Freddy, and Joey then falls into a coma and he wakes up kind of in the dream while strapped to a bed, hovering over what can be only be described as the pits of hell, with these animatronic tongues, you know, keeping him strapped to the bed, as you do. He terrorizes recovering drug addict with knives that turn into syringes. Jennifer, an inspiring actress, ends up in the TV. You get the gist. Another example is with Philip, and this has to be the creepiest kill, as it just seems to last so long and it just looks so painful. Philip likes to carve puppets, and one night Freddy, of course, uses this against him and turns into a puppet. Freddy then appears at the end of his bed and he kind of pulls his veins. He doesn't kind of do it, he does it. He pulls his veins out of his arms and his legs and makes him into a puppet. And this manipulation where he's forced to walk to the top of a building to his death is horrific. But what makes it worse is all the other kids see it. They can see the fear in his eyes, and they can tell he doesn't want to jump. And to the staff, this is nothing more than a freak accident. It just looks like he couldn't handle it anymore, and therefore he went up to the top of a building, committed suicide. And, you know, to be fair, you can kind of see why they come to that conclusion. And Philip is the first to go. But another thing is, because of what is done and the kids know what happened, they now know fully what Freddy is capable of and what he could do and what lengths he would go to actually kill them. And, you know, the aftermath also shows the real frustration for the kids as they try and explain to Dr. Sims, especially that Philip was murdered, but, you know, she's just not bloody having it because it doesn't make any sense. So basically, they know they are all fucked. While all these scenes of all these kids dying is truly horrific, ones that I find that are really unsettling is the actual young kids in it. I mean, the ones that look about six. When Kirsten's in her dreams and she's at the Elm Street house, we see this young girl on a bike in a yellow dress, and, you know, she plays like a normal child, and outside there's all these other kids playing, they're skipping, they're having fun. But it's really dark and sinister, the whole setting around it. It's not the nice, you know, white picket fence that we were used to in the first one. And, you know, I think at times like this, we tend to forget sometimes that what these characters actually are, as in Kruger. He was a serial killer, but we're all fans of the character and we think he's great. You know, like Michael Myers and Jason. But at the end of the day, they're all brutal killers. But because they're fictional, it's okay to kind of like fan girl over them. You know, you can say what you want, you can think they're awesome with no judgment because they're not real. although some people do give you a few looks when you're kind of going on about how amazing Freddy Krueger is. And when we look at serial killers out there, you know, we often come across ones that have no remorse. And I think this is Freddy. He couldn't give a shit. He's one of the worst kind of serial killers because he has no remorse. There is no love in him, no kindness. He is pure evil. And granted, the way he was conceived is not, you know, it's not the greatest start to life. And it really didn't get much better after that. You know, he was adopted by an abusive alcoholic. He was taunted in school on a regular basis. He really didn't stand a chance. But is that an excuse? Of course not. But like many serial killers, you do wonder, had things been different, how their lives would have been. Plus, Freddy is also one of the worst, not only because it's kids, but because he enjoys it. With his kills, they're not quick. He taunts them. He loves it. And he just wants more and more. And he is one of those killers that would never stop. And let's not forget that cackle of a laugh. Pure evil. But he does get his comeuppance, and that is with everyone's favourite gang, the Dream Warriors. They do bring it together. They pull themselves together to defeat Freddy. Nancy is there until the very end, and also for these kids, she really is their best shot at survival. And after being stabbed, she still manages to get up and stick his own glove into him, saving Kirsten. While she's there with all the kids, Neil has gone to this kind of car graveyard place with Kirsten's dad to get the bones and throw holy water over. And as he is throwing holy water over, we see shoots of bright light coming through Freddy, and then he just disappears. Kincaid, Joey and Kirsten, they are the survivors, but as we know, Freddy never truly leaves us, and he will be back soon to terrorize us once more in A Nightmare on Elm Street 4. But overall, this film is a great film and one I will continue to go back with, and I feel if The Breakfast Club was a horror movie, then this would be it. But I'd like to say thank you for listening, and don't forget to rate and review on iTunes. You can find me on Instagram as Once Upon a Nightmare, Twitter as A Nightmare Pod, Letterboxd as A Nightmare Pod, and you can email me onceuponanightmarepod@gmail.com, and I will chat to you all very soon. Bye.
Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3. Freddy's just around the corner.